La Jolla, California, UC San Diego Athletics presents TritonCast, the podcast for the UC San Diego Tritons. Here are your hosts, Jeff Toriel and Jenny Stevens.
Welcome to episode 23 of TritonCast, the official podcast for UC San Diego Athletics. Alongside Jeff Toriel, I'm Jenny Stevens. No matter where you found us, we're so glad that you joined us this week. And if you like what you hear, do us a favor and subscribe, rate the show, and write us a brief review. We'd really appreciate that. What do we have coming up today, Jeff?
Jenny, this is a fantastic show. Coming up today in the Triton Spotlight, we're going to chat with men's basketball alum Jordan Lawley. He excelled during his time with the Tritons and helped the team to their first ever NCAA Division II postseason appearance. Basketball continued to be prominent in his life after graduating. He played professionally around the globe and has worked as a trainer. And now, Jordan trains some of the NBA's top athletes, and he overcame a major health setback along the way. Our conversation with Jordan Lawley, trust me, you're not going to want to miss it, will come your way shortly in this week's Triton Spotlight.
But first, we go around campus. Speaking of basketball, head over to UCSDTritons.com to read about Kendall Ellenbeck and Emerson Herman of the women's team. They shared about their experiences growing up with type 1 diabetes and how they manage it today. And while you're on the site, make sure to check out the results of the recent Triton Athletes Council virtual canned food drive.
And now let's move on to this week's Triton Spotlight. Here's our conversation with UC San Diego men's basketball alum, Jordan Lawley.
So, Jordan, before we dive into everything with your career, let's start off with your time at UC San Diego. How did you end up at UCSD?
It didn't take much. I mean, it's located in one of the best cities in the world, in La Jolla. And I actually came down on my official visit, and I did it just because I wanted to go down and check out San Diego. I'd currently been on official visits to Yale, Dartmouth, Harvard, and Cornell. And UCSD was just kind of like, hey, I just want to go down to San Diego, see what it's like. And I absolutely fell in love with the campus. I fell in love with the players. I felt like they best represented who I was as an individual and what I thought of as basketball being just a vessel for my education and to further my intellect or my career. And I never thought of it as a means to an end. And that led me to signing with them literally, I want to say it was like the week after, or committing to them, the week after my visit.
Wow, such a cool experience. I mean, that's awesome just when you click with a school right away. And yeah. I mean, when you got to UCSD, you made an immediate impact because in your freshman year, you played in all 27 games for the Tritons. What was it like for you making that adjustment to college basketball?
It was definitely a realization that I was playing against men. I think I weighed 155 pounds when I graduated high school, entering college. So I learned very quickly that I had to put some meat on my bones and actually become a man very fast. And that was probably the biggest extent because I had never touched a weight or done any type of weight training leading up to that point. So it came down to the physicality, brute physicality of it. And that's something that I needed to get up to speed. So I gained 35 pounds my freshman campaign from when I entered school. I think I came down August to our first game. I gained 35 pounds. So it definitely was a shock from a physicality aspect.
Wow. And clearly adding that bulk really paid off for you because I mean, like we said, freshman year, you made an immediate impact. And then your sophomore year, you led the team to their first NCAA Division II tournament berth. What was that experience like for you?
It was cool. And at the time, I didn't really think anything of it because, you know, I was in high school, I was used to making it to section finals and we had a winning team. And, going into a program, they didn't have, a ton of past successes. It wasn't something that was of shock to me or didn't hit home as much as maybe it should have. And then it didn't really make an impact until after I left. And, I go back and you look through the accolades, past accolades, and you're like, man, we made it to our first playoff berth, in school history as D2. That's a pretty substantial, feat. So it definitely made an impact later on when I graduated. But at the time, like, I didn't truly appreciate it enough. But it was a fun group. It was an amazing group of guys. And don't get me wrong, I wasn't the sole proprietor on that team at all. It was definitely a team effort, and we had some amazing integral pieces.
When you look back on that group of guys, what do you feel like it was that made that team so special?
I think we just had a little bit of everything. There was no like one true Hollywood standout. It was, brand new coach. So we were excited. We were, had a tough year prior with the coach, our coach at the time. So getting some fresh blood in there that gave us a little bit more free rein and less structure is always a welcoming thing toward, toward a team. And it just helps with team morale. So and then we had guys that, could fill all roles. And that's something that wasn't, there, the year prior.
Well, that NCAA Division II tournament berth was one of many achievements during your time at UC San Diego. I mean, individually, you also earned many awards, and you graduated as the team's all-time leading scorer, among other records. So when you look back on all the achievements, what sticks out to you the most?
The all-time leading scorer one was one that I really hung my hat on until a couple of players that I actually train that come out to my facility and train with me beat my record at UCSD. So I'm kind of sick about that, but I'm very excited for them. But yeah, that once again, it's one of those things like in the moment at the time, I had no idea what I was doing. And I didn't even learn that I beat the scoring record until after the game that I did it. So it was just one of those things, unbeknownst to me, that these things were occurring, but it really did make me feel like I actually left a positive mark on the school.
Yeah, absolutely. And how was it for you balancing your athletics with your academics while you were at UC San Diego?
Freaking tough. UCSD functions as an Ivy League school, and it's, it literally academics trump athletics, and it's always been that way. And rightfully so, like we're one of the top, academies for intellects for especially for a public university. And, I went into that knowing that. And once I got there, I realized that it was definitely true, and we weren't going to get any outside help. So you had to really manage, your time wisely. And at that moment, I was on the team, I was running a business, and I had, school to balance and a girlfriend constantly at the time. So there was a lot of variables that were in my equation, but it was never a means. It's kind of easier like when you're thrown into the UCSD mix because everybody's studying. So it makes you easier or more reluctant to fall into studying at Geisel and all these different places. So that part, like being in that element, with a very studious student, was a lot easier for me to fall into being studious as well.
And at what point then did you start thinking about your future and playing professional basketball?
One game before the last game. So our second to last game, a couple of agents like sent me messages saying, "Hey, we noticed you made an impact at your school. We would love to represent you when, if you choose to play professionally." And before, it was not even considered. And I would, crazy to even say that in 2010, playing professional basketball after college was not something that, a lot of people did, like maybe some high major D1s or mid major D1 players, but it wasn't as like acceptable or sought after for D2. And I want to say I was one of the first players of UCSD to actually go and play professional basketball. So it definitely wasn't anything that I thought I was going to extend my career and continue to play until got down to the end of my career and people started showing interest in what I, my potential of playing at the next level.
What was that realization like for you emotionally, thinking that you could extend your basketball career?
It was eye-opening. It was eye-opening on a couple of different facets. One, it could satisfy an urge for me to, you know, for traveling. Like I always wanted, I love traveling, and I studied in Costa Rica my junior to senior year in college, like over summer. I went and I had a South Africa trip planned with my buddy upon graduation. So there was a lot of these things that I was currently in that market of like traveling. And when I found out that some teams wanted me to play overseas, like it was like, oh man, this is awesome. I can continue to travel. On another part, it made me realize that I was actually doing something with the sport. Like while I was, you know, kind of in, I hate to say this, but D2 athletics kind of has a negative stigma. And even though there's a lot of Division II players that can outplay, hands down, run teams off Division I teams and players off the court, it's just the stigma that, oh, you chose D2, so you must be lesser than. And for me, like I always went into my basketball playing career as like, okay, means to an end with my education, and I'm just doing it at a Division II level, so it's not that, like, there's really nothing that I, you know, I can get out of it other than these personal accolades and, you know, some little team success that we had. And like that was it. So it allowed me to see that I was attaining notice from a lot of grander of scale. So that from an internal perspective felt really good.
Then where did you end up after you first started your professional basketball career?
So I ended up getting a couple of tryouts for NBA G League teams. I was actually on the training camp roster for the Reno Bighorns. And then I actually left that obligation to go play in New Zealand. So I played New Zealand, and then I played for a stint in Chihuahua, Mexico.
I know you mentioned that you love to travel. How was it playing in those different places?
New Zealand is one of the best countries in the world. It is an amazing place, beautiful, amazing people. The food is great. Like there's no language barrier. So for a rookie going into a new country, like that's always a lot smoother of a transition. So there was a lot of solid like aspects of it, that, especially like for a rookie, that made it so convenient and such a great experience. Mexico was a different experience to say the least. I speak Spanish, so the language barrier wasn't a big adjustment. However, it was during the drug war, like regime change. And that definitely had some different repercussions, you know, when you were, you know, found yourself outside of the game or hotel atmosphere. So, definitely a different experience, but in the same token, like I was still able to attain so many great experiences and life lessons in each location that have lasted, you know, will last me for the rest of my life.
That's awesome. Overall, was the professional basketball experience what you expected it to be?
No. When you realize that you're actually playing basketball for a paycheck and that you're pretty much dispensable and you're looked at as a commodity, like it is, takes a lot of that love away from it. And the fact that, you know, I'm a mama's boy at heart and I love my family, and my parents never missed a single game from my high school, crap, and maybe even from my middle school all the way through college. They never missed a single basketball game. So I went from having this piece of me in the stands every game to being on the other side, 18-hour difference or whatever it was. And my parents never being able to watch a live game, and that hurt a ton. So that right there took a lot of that love and appreciation for the sport, kind of took it away from me. And it made me realize exactly what meant, you know, the most to me. You know, here's a collegiate athlete who has an opportunity to play a professional sport and travel. And all I can think about is embracing my parents or my loved ones after a game. You know, you realize that your relationships, you know, or family trump the love you have for this sport. And that was an eye-opening experience for me.
That's so interesting and how much it told you about yourself, just being able to have this experience. How was it from a perspective of playing? Like, was there a significant step up from the college level to the professional level?
There was in the fact that they look at certain people as being I never felt like I was looked at as like, hey, if you don't produce this game, you're going to be on the chopping block and you maybe get fired. Like, you never have that. You have the luxury of knowing that you are going to be stuck in that position, or you're going to maintain your position throughout the whole year from a collegiate perspective, versus from the professional perspective. Like, there's a lot of emotional and mental stress that goes into each game and each, you know, practice when you have to worry if you don't perform, you're going to lose your job. So mentally, physically, it was completely fine. Mentally, it was definitely an added stressor when having to play games knowing that it could be your last.
We're chatting with Jordan Lawley here on this episode of TritonCast. Jordan, at what point did you make the transition from playing professionally to training professionally?
So I always had like training clients or clients that I would train throughout college. It was just for extra side money and just to, you know, help out and just to dabble at it. However, when I got done playing, I had hopes of, I took my LSAT, took my GMAT. I was going to be, you know, go to USF to become an agent. And that's what I wanted to do. And in the interim, like me doing my LSAT and GMAT, getting my scores back, I actually worked for one of my clients. I worked in a desk job. I also owned a property management company with my brothers. So they came from a very entrepreneurial background. And I thought, like, okay, I have to do something that has financial stability and structure. And, you know, I want to do it, you know, the real way. So basketball training was never something that I thought was going to be a continued career. It was just something that I thought, like, okay, this could produce a little bit extra side money. And it wasn't until I realized that my desk job that I had at the time, and after I got my LSAT and GMAT scores and realized that continuing education probably wasn't going to be the best fit, that I, you know, started noticing my 9 to 5 turned to 9 to 3, and then my 9 to 3 turned to 9 to noon, and my 9 to noon turned into a 2 weeks notice where I was like, listen, I have too many clients now that I've acquired that are taking up a majority of my time for training. Like, I can't, you know, work. And it was a very cool moment because this something that was so organic, I was able to see grow right in front of my eyes without putting much effort. And don't get me wrong, I used like Craigslist and all these like cool little, you know, interesting marketing platforms to promote my business and promote my brand or promote my training business. And I was able to attract a bunch of clientele. So I was making a career wage off of part-time position. And at that moment I realized, okay, this needs to be a transition point. But to answer your question a little bit more directly, when I got done playing in Mexico, I realized that playing basketball professionally probably wasn't going to be all it's cracked up to be. And I didn't know exactly how far it could take me. So that's when I made the decision to transition to the professionals, an alternate profession.
I know you mentioned that you were getting some clients from Craigslist and online. Was that how you built your clientele, or was it more word of mouth that you were getting people?
Word of mouth in any service industry is always going to trump a lot of marketing tactics. However, I felt like I was one of the first to market on like Craigslist, and I was ransacking that platform. Like, you couldn't go 3 clicks down without seeing another J-Law B-Ball, Jordan Lawley Basketball, I train, we out train, like these like push marketing strategies. And I had at the time, I had a Toyota Prius that I had bought, and I wrapped the whole Toyota Prius to my company logo and, you know, a big QR code. I thought it was super progressive. QR scanner on the back of my car. Like it was wild. Like, looking in retrospect, I look like an absolute moron, but it was probably one of the smartest like decisions, because I was driving 100+ miles a day training from, you know, downtown San Diego or Chula Vista all the way up to Carlsbad, Encinitas. So I was constantly moving around, and it was able to kind of little bighorn a lot of different locales that were very lucrative, like the La Jolla, like all these little pockets were hearing about me that I wasn't in, and it was attracting more business from the more affluent areas. So it helped kind of grow my brand from a foundation, or grow my business from a foundational aspect. And then it was a lot easier to build up.
I love that you're driving around with the Prius. Did anybody ever come to you and say that they got the QR code from your car?
So many people, it was sickening. so many people, a lot of them said, hey, I tried to scan the QR code. It didn't work because we were moving on the freeway. So that part was a little bit frustrating, but so many people attempted.
I know you've worked with players of all different levels. At what point did you start working with higher profile players like NBA players?
It started after I'd gotten into the good graces of San Diego State, which I'm extremely thankful to Coach Fisher and the San Diego State staff for allowing me the opportunity to work with their players. You know, here I am, a competitor in preseason. Here I am, a lesser than, you know, Division II player. But, you know, when I got done, like, they didn't see me as such. They saw me for what I was able to do with their players, and they gave me the opportunity to work with a lot of their higher-level guys. And this was during the era of, like, Kawhi Leonard, Jamal Franklin, Tim Shelton, like, a lot of these guys that I had access to that, you know, in essence, like, looking back at what I was back then, like, I feel like I didn't know anything, but they gave me the opportunity. So at that moment, it was like about a year worth of grinding, training like high level college players that I was able to crack the NBA surface and get my first NBA client. And from there, it was kind of snowballed. And a lot of that is due to confidence. Like, you end up with like a confident, you know, the way you feel confidently coming out of a session with an NBA guy, you know, it just exudes out of your pores leading forward. So that helped out a ton with my confidence as a teacher.
What's the adjustment like now that you're working, or at the time when you started working with these high profile Division I players and NBA players?
The adjustment is knowing that it doesn't need to be a universal session. It needs to be more task oriented for the individual. That's something that it took me a little bit of time to get used to. Here I was teaching 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds, remedial basketball, like very, very new, you know, beginner level players. And you taught in breadth, like versus detail orientate, or versus like a strict guideline on what that individual needed to get better with. And when you get up to higher level players, higher level athletes, it's really important that you make it more focused around their individualized game and the areas that they need for that next season. Not 3 years ahead, but you focus on what they need for that next season based off of what the team asks of them. And it took me a little bit of time to realize that I'm helping a player excel at a business position. And like, that is probably one of the biggest like changes or shifts when operating or training NBA players.
How do you feel like your professional background and your time playing college basketball at UC San Diego figures into all of this?
It definitely figures into the fact that I had success. So I get a little bit of respect from that matter, even if it's coming from a D2, I've had individual and team success. And then it just gives me, like, I feel like we play basketball the right way. Efficient, very efficient and detail oriented. It wasn't ISO basketball. It was just good, well-rounded basketball that, you know, you made the right play for the right person at the right moment. And I think that helped a lot with my understanding of the sport and gave me a little bit of a leg up and an opportunity to teach college and NBA players well.
Well, you've built up an incredibly impressive clientele. Who are some of your favorite players that you've worked with over the years?
CJ McCollum, Zach LaVine, and Klay Thompson. Man, Julius Randle, Thon Maker, like those are probably my top five. And I'm sorry if I left anybody out, but Klay is probably one of my favorite players that I've worked with all time. Just due to the fact that he's such an easygoing guy, and he's there, you know, not just to get better, but he's there to enjoy himself. And for me, like, we've created an environment that's more family oriented, who cares about the individual, the transformation, not the transaction. And Klay and I aligned very well, very early on when we started working with him. And it was just so much easier to teach guys that are in the same headspace and have the same interests as you. And in the training world and any service industry, like attracts like. And the fact that we were able to kind of fall into each other's, you know, arms with the training in the training space. Like it was a really cool environment that he created.
What's the process like then when a guy like Clay reaches out to you?
We assess kind of what his strengths are from an individual perspective, what the team asks of him and what his weaknesses are. And like when we started working with Clay, we knew what he could do extremely well, and that's shoot the freaking ball. Like he's the best shooter possibly to ever play the sport. However, off dribble stuff, things that, you know, he hasn't done a lot, we knew that we needed to kind of approach that. And this was going into an era where Steph Curry was injured, so he was going to have to take a little bit more of that ball per possession. So he was going to have to put the ball on the ground a little bit more. So we worked on ball handling, his ability to, you know, shoot off of dribbles or off moves in isolation. So that was our primary focus. And then getting into his game shots that he's more comfortable with.
So you've mentioned some of your favorite players that you've worked with. Who's your dream player if you could choose one person to work with?
Giannis Antetokounmpo. No doubt about it.
Why so?
I think he's going to be one of the best players to ever play the game. I think when he figures out how to shoot the ball consistently from three, he will be one of the most dominant players ever.
Well, when you're training these guys, whether it's somebody at the NBA level or even college or high school, what does it mean to you when you work with someone and you see them have success on the court?
It makes me feel amazing. But in the same token, it's one of those things I don't get too caught up in it, because I know that skills trainers, guys like me, have such little to do with the outward success of our clients. Like, I'm just excited they're able to attain success and have some vote of confidence for their efforts that they put forth in the gym, you know, training. But that's one thing that I never want to get it twisted. Like, I'm a marginal tool for these athletes, both at amateur and professional level. It's all on that athlete to, you know, have those little aha moments where they realize, like, hey, this is what's going to actually work for that individual.
So, I mean, average people like me, we see these guys on TV playing in their games. What do you feel like the average person doesn't really know about the training behind the scenes kind of portion of the work that goes in?
That they're human. And I think that gets misconstrued a lot. A lot of times people can watch a game and critique an individual because they missed three times. And they kind of have this stigma that, oh, this person is in the NBA, they must be perfect at everything that they do. And that's not the case. What they're very good and perfect at what they do is having short memories and making sure that they focus intently and being extremely detail oriented on the things that they need to do within that workout. And that's something that I applaud every athlete that plays at the professional level, is because it takes so much grit and focus to compete and to better yourself at that next level. And that's something that gets highly overlooked. They just get looked at as a robot, as a perfect robot that cannot make mistakes or should not make mistakes, or just kind of naturally comes to them. And a lot of it doesn't. A lot of it is earned in the training realm.
Well, I think you do a great job of exhibiting how human these guys are, because on your social media, it's filled with behind the scenes videos and photos of your training sessions. Do you feel like social media has helped play a role in your success at all?
I think so. I think social media helped create a market for trainers like me. It's created a market for videographers. It's created an opportunity for brands to attract not just like players, but another avenue to attract coaches like me, to attract, therefore, the grassroots basket. Like, so I think trainers have had a very odd impact, or have had a very odd and profitable kind of advantage with social media. And it's something that, you know, I've definitely taken advantage of over the past few years that social media has kind of boomed.
Do you enjoy getting to interact with fans on the social media platforms?
I love it. I'm very outgoing and kind of a big dork when it comes to it. Like, I genuinely just love being happy and enjoying myself. And it makes it really easy to kind of showcase my floundering personality when I'm on social.
We're chatting with Jordan Lawley here on this episode of Tritoncast. Jordan, I want to switch gears because our listeners might be familiar with your ties to basketball, but they might not know that you're also a brain tumor survivor. So take me back and talk to me a little bit about when you first found out.
Yeah, so I got in a car accident in October of 2018, and it was on the freeway, and it's a pretty bad one where I got sideswiped, spun out, hit 12 cars, like ended up walking out of the, crawling out of my car, and I was completely fine. But my knees were pretty banged up, and a couple days after the accident, once the adrenaline kind of calms down and you start realizing the aches and pains that are actually there, I noticed that I needed to get an MRI checked or MRI on my knees. So I told my lawyer for the accident to my doctor that I needed to get an MRI on my knees, and scheduled it, went and showed up to the MRI appointment. And right before I got in the tube, they're like, okay, now the tube's going to go from the top of your head to the middle of your chest. And I looked at her, I was like, you know, that's a lot of real estate between the neck and the knees. You sure that's going to be able to, you know, get down there and check out my knees? And they're like, no, this is actually for your upper neck. So I was like, okay, whatever. I'm very liquid when it comes to it. So I was like, whatever, I'll do it. And then I'll just schedule another one. So I got done with the MRI, and it was like a week later. I was going to my chiropractor, and they got the results back, and they were labeling off everything, and everything sounded good. So I left the chiropractor's office and went back the next day again to get adjusted. And there was a new technician who read my results again. She was like, hey, you know, looks like there's a 4 centimeter mass that's, you know, near your cerebellum. It's probably nothing, but you should probably get it checked out. So I was like, oh, well, it's probably nothing. So I just left it for a couple of weeks and didn't think anything of it. And then went back again. She said the same thing, that I should probably get it checked out. So I was like, okay, you know, I feel like if you brought it up more than once, then I probably should. So I ended up going, getting a brain MRI, which was more detailed and was able to tell exactly what that mass might be. And we found out it was an acoustic neuroma, which is a tumor that's attached to your acoustic nerve, which affects your hearing, your facial nerve, which affects the mobility of your face, and then your vestibular nerve, which affects all balance and coordination. And they told me that it was a stage 4, which is the largest of the brain tumors. Benign tumor, so it was non-cancerous, thank God, but it was the largest type of tumor. And though where mine was kind of positioned was pushing against my brainstem, which if it impeded my brainstem enough, it could leave me paralyzed. And I was completely asymptomatic leading up to it, had no symptoms whatsoever. So this is something that literally could have just continued to grow. And then at a moment when it got too big, it could have left me paralyzed without me even knowing. So complete God thing on how we found it. You know, at the time that we did. And then to take it one step kind of further in this crazy experience, I didn't know, I knew my sister-in-law worked for a surgeon as a nurse, but I did not know to what extent. And I come to find out that she works for one of the top neurosurgeons who specializes in acoustic neuromas. And his father actually wrote the textbook on how to remove acoustic neuromas. So I was able to get into surgery like a couple months later. Like they, you know, fast tracked my surgery date, and it was just something like complete God thing on how everything fell into place. And for me to be able to, you know, get my surgery and kind of continue to, you know, live my new life. And after surgery, I had facial paralysis on the right side of my face. I'm deaf completely in the right ear now. My balance is that of a geriatric. So if somebody, you know, think of your grandpa or grandma in the nursing home, like that's what my balance is now. So there's a lot of deficiencies and handicaps that I have, but, I had my left glute, my left butt cheek, actually died because I was on the surgical table for 12 hours through my surgery, and my muscle lost oxygen completely. So I don't have a fully functioning glute. So there's like a lot of like negligent, or not negligent, but a lot of negative things that happened. But there hasn't been a single day or moment where I haven't felt so truly blessed for the things that I do have. Like, so many people will say, hey, I can't believe you're deaf. Like, I would hate life, you know, or deaf in the right ear. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I have a perfectly great left ear. And that is something that I'm holding on to. Or like, oh, I can't believe, I don't know how you do it with like not having your balance back, like after playing professional basketball and being so like balance oriented. Like, basketball is all balance, no matter what anyone says. And like, I just think I see it as a challenge to kind of push forward through it. And like, it's like being able to, you know, play a game blindfolded. Like, I feel like it's challenging me in so many different ways and making this game something that's so new and exciting to play. As much as I do have my frustrations at times, like, I just feel ultimately blessed that I'm able to, be standing here and be able to play, you know, the game that I still love.
Wow. What an inspiring perspective. And I mean, were you this positive throughout the whole entire experience, or were there times where it was a struggle for you?
And I'm not just saying this to say or to sound like strong, but I'm a firm believer that uncommon situations happen to people with uncommon faith. And that was like my main theme throughout this surgery. And I knew that, you know, God had a larger purpose for me going through this, you know, devastating moment. And the one thing that was probably the hardest to deal with was knowing that my wife was pregnant at the time. And we had a 2-year-old boy. And so there was a lot of emotions and definitely trying times that she had. And I felt like I was just a burden on her. Because like when I got done with surgery, there was a good month where I couldn't do much. I could hardly walk. I had to relearn how to walk. Like after surgery, I couldn't move the right side of my face. So it was hard to do a lot of, you know, normalized functions. Like there was a lot of things that I feel like she had to take care of me, a baby who was born, our baby girl was born less than April, May, June, less than a month and a half after my surgery, and a 2.5 terrible two, you know, boy that, you know, is going through a pretty dramatic time and, you know, in his life. And I look back and I think of how strong my wife was. But so that was like the hardest thing for me looking back, or the hardest time that I had, was knowing that I was a burden on somebody that I truly loved. But on a positive spectrum, like I've so many people, because I put it out on social, or because I've done podcasts like this to tell my story, have reached out to me and they found out that they had the same tumor or their parents were going through something that was similar. And I was able to give them my number and talk to them and tell them a little bit of what faith has done for me. So it was definitely my calling, and I felt like it was something that needed to be done. And I feel honored that it was done to me, so that way I can positively affect others.
Yeah, that is such a miracle. I mean, what was the recovery process then like? Are you still kind of recovering today, or are you in just like a state that you'll continue to be in?
So the development or the growth is very, very marginal now. I still feel like I'm on a boat 24/7. So it's the vertigo, like my focus is very spotty. So if you try to like track a finger that's going across your face, my eyes don't operate as fast as, or my neurons can't fire as fast. So it takes me a very long time to spot moving targets fast. And that affects your balance. Not having hearing in my right ear also affects my balance. So my balance is still pretty, there's still a pretty large deficit. However, it has gotten better, and I still see like little growth every 6 months in certain areas. And I think that's just because it's becoming a little bit more of my new normal, and I'm accepting that a little bit more. But I still am holding on to a little bit more of what I used to be like. And we're sitting at about a year and a half after my surgery.
I know you mentioned earlier that obviously that presents challenges for your profession. In what ways have you overcome those challenges or adapted?
So I got a hearing aid. It's a hearing aid like 2 weeks ago. And I feel like that was a great step forward for me. Accepting external help is something that I've always like kind of negated and really strayed away from. I've always felt like I just need to handle this myself and I'll pray about it. And, you know, I'll do that. And a lot of times, like when you pray about it, you don't feel like anything's happening. Like there's really a lot of things that are happening. Like God's putting different sources in your life. And I just sometimes fail to accept it as something that I struggle with. And one of my neurosurgeon actually told me about hearing aids and how this one could help. And I was always kind of putting it off. And then I finally was like, yeah, let's do it. And it's actually a microphone on my bad ear and a receiver in my good ear. So one of the like biggest like issues with being unilaterally deaf is you don't know where sound is coming from. So like, and you can't hear obviously anything that anybody's saying on your bad side. So like when I get to a dinner table or get into the gym where sound is crazy and it could be coming from different angles and there could be somebody standing right there, it's very difficult to function, very overwhelming. That, and I have tinnitus like 24/7. So just a loud, high-pitched ringing in my right ear constantly. And with this hearing aid, it kind of gives me the opportunity to hear when somebody's standing on my right side. So when I get to a dinner table or get into the gym, like I can actually now pick up sound on this right side that then transmits it to my good ear. So it has opened up my ears per se to being able to hear a little bit more of this going on. So that way I'm not constantly asking what or trying to decipher and read lips. Thank you, COVID-19, for putting face masks over every individual, which makes it a little bit more, just a little bit trickier, but that part has helped me out a ton. I took up acupuncture, which has helped me a lot with my vestibular function. There's been a bunch of different areas that I've definitely reached out, different methods that have helped me in kind of coping with my deficiencies. But still, I think it's going to be some time before I can reach a comfortable level of norm.
Do you know what's next for you? I mean, do you have any goals as far as training or what the future holds?
Yeah, we're starting up a company, a global company. It's a trainers association, which just kind of gives stability and the governing factor to the trainer world. Because it's kind of, trainers are kind of like the Wild Wild West. We have no guidelines. We have no structure. It's very individualized. There's no core network. It's a lot of just individualized groups who believe they do the right thing and they just run with it. So we want to give a little bit of structure and government to the training world, kind of like how NASM is for athletic training. And that's something that we're looking to get into. I'm hoping to not be on the basketball court within 5 years. So retirement is something that I'm looking to do here very shortly. I say that, but in the same breath, like I love what I do and I love being on the court, like helping individuals. And I love being in front of the camera. I know it sounds super vain, but I love just having fun in front of the camera. So there's a lot of like what ifs, but I want to be around my kids while they're growing up, and that's something that's really important to me.
Well, we are just about out of time for today. So last question for you, Jordan, if our listeners want to keep up with you or reach out to you about training, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah. So you can follow us on all social channels at JLawBball and then our Jordan Lawley Basketball. It's just jordanlawley.com is our website. There's all our contact info and opportunities for you to get involved and help better develop your training.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Jordan. This was great.
course, Jennifer, I had fun.
Wow, Jenny, so much there. I don't even know where to start. I mean, what he's gone through just recently with the car accident, which led to the MRI, which led to discovering the brain tumor. I mean, that's just a lot for anyone to handle. And it is so impressive how he's maintained that positive attitude and how his faith has helped propel him through a very, very difficult situation.
Absolutely. Just listening to Jordan talk, I was so inspired. And I mean, like you said, it's crazy how it started from that car accident. It's just, it was so much for one person to process at once, but definitely with his faith and his family, he was able to get through it. And it's really great to see that he's thriving today.
Well, that, and prior to that, you're playing overseas. Well, first of all, having the stellar career at UC San Diego, still ranking in the top 10 all time in scoring in program history, and then playing overseas and then building this business. I mean, that's just a textbook success story.
Right. I mean, what he's accomplished in such a short amount of time is just incredible.
Well, you're not going to want to miss our fantastic lineup coming up in the month of December on TritonCast. We'll chat with Toronto native Katya Pavichevich, who made an immediate impact on the Triton swim team as she started her career last season. We'll also hear from Holly Main of the water polo program about her experience as a 13-time national champion in U.S. life-saving competitions. Plus, we've got UC San Diego physics professor Adam Bergasser, who is a national champion springboard diver for the Tritons, all coming up in the month of December. New episodes of TritonCast premiere each Wednesday.
Thanks so much for listening today. For more on TritonCast, give us a follow on Twitter at TritonCast. And if you've got suggestions for a future guest, feel free to send a tweet to Jeff and me at TritonCast or email us at TritonCast@UCSD.edu. We'll see you back here next week.
You've been listening to TritonCast. TritonCast is a production of UC San Diego Athletics Communications. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast on your platform of choice. If you have show questions or comments or suggestions for future guests, email us at TritonCast@UCSD.edu. You can also follow the show on Twitter at TritonCast. We'll be right back.